Third Coast Digest is brought to you in part by 91.7 FM, WMSE Frontier Radio.
Bruce Wilson, welcome. Thanks for coming in. Now, I'm calling you Bruce Wilson, not Dr. Bruce Wilson, because I don't want you to feel like an old guy. But you are a doctor, correct?
I am.
A cardiologist in particular?
That's correct.
Do you have a specialty within the cardiological range of specialties?
Well, I spent many years doing invasive and interventional cardiology, angioplasty and stents and pacemakers and things like
that. So a surgeon, okay.
Not a surgeon. Actually, there's a distinction. Cardiac surgeons have large instruments that make noise and smoke, and they're real men.
And leave big staples behind.
They leave big marks behind, and I always say that cardiologists are about the only people on earth who could tell a cardiac surgeon what to do. So I'm a medical cardiologist, and I have dropped my interventional practice. I do a lot of consultation, and all my work is really out of the office and not in the hospital anymore.
Ah, that's an interesting thing to pursue. You do a lot of speaking, public speaking then, or?
I do. One of my other special interests is stress and its effects on health and wellness and performance. So I have a separate company called Heart Matters that is a venue for me lecturing and giving seminars on stress and how to break it.
Right.
And I have served as a hospice director for a few years, about 8 or 9 years ago. And so I have a very strong predilection toward discussing end-of-life issues.
Okay. That's why I wanted to speak with you, actually. I was introduced to you. I met you because the end-of-life issues are their issues that I concern myself with, because we don't have a freedom of choice, particularly when it comes to that. Not that we are even, sometimes we're not even able to make the choice. But there are states where it's provided for, Montana, I believe, Washington, Oregon, where you can get doctors, you can have doctor-assisted suicide. Is that correct?
That's true. The usual term for that is physician-assisted suicide. There are a couple of other ones. But in 1996 or 98, Oregon passed the law that allowed for physician-assisted suicide. And much more recently, the states of Montana and Washington have passed similar legislation. And it's my understanding that this issue is really on the table at the state legislature level in almost every state and comes up almost yearly in some states and so far has not been voted on in the affirmative in most of those states.
It's a difficult topic to talk about. I find it difficult because death is a difficult topic to talk about. I mean, because we don't know very much about it.
Is that the reason you think? It's that we don't know about it?
Well, I have lots of theories about the fact that we don't know about it. I think the fact that we don't know about it is probably, to expose myself completely, is probably the cause of most organized religion and most of the superstition that we have lived with for years and years and years, centuries.
I'd agree that that's an interesting component of it. But think about this. We have come so far medically, technologically, that it is the opinion of our culture in general that doctors can solve any problem, that we can get anybody to go a little bit longer, a little bit longer. Now, if you take our community back 100 or 150 years, we were an agricultural society,
right,
and we lived on farms, and death was all around us. We slaughtered the pig and made pork chops. We planted corn and harvested and ate, and we plant some more next year.
Right. We had many, many children because some of them would die.
Exactly right. And we needed them on the farm. You needed enough kids to work the farm. And
right,
many people, kids would die. Infant mortality and childhood mortality is much higher. And let's not forget the standard way of dying. Heart disease is the main killer of people and has been for a long time in most Western cultures. But when grandpa fell off the tractor, then you call Doc and Doc comes over on his carriage, or maybe in an early Model A Ford or something like that. It took him a couple hours to get there.
Right.
And Grandpa is still dead. And he says, yep, Grandpa's dead. And it's a sad moment, but then you call the undertaker, and the undertaker helps you get him into the house, and somehow you get him into his Navy suit, and you put him on the dining room table, and then all you and the family and all the neighbors gather around and have some whiskey, and the next day you have a burial.
And you get back out in the field because those crops aren't going to wait.
Right. So this was familiar to us. So familiarity makes things not so scary. It was the cycle of life, and we were right in the middle of it. But since medicine has been able to do so much, especially in the last 50 years, and people watch television, you may have noticed.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
You watch ER or any of the television shows, and these complicated, horrible cases come in, and in 11 minutes and 28 seconds, just before the next commercial, the guy is cured and goes home. So it is the expectation of the public that death really doesn't exist, or you can always stave it off. And when Grandpa now has a heart attack and Grandpa's in the ICU, the kids aren't allowed to go visit Grandpa, so they don't see near death or death. So we have an unfamiliarity with death now. And the way the human brain works, the human brain is not really like a computer. It's a pattern-matching organ.
Mm-hmm.
So things that are familiar to us, we either recognize as familiar and safe, so we don't need to worry or get anxious about it, or familiar and threatening.
Right.
Things that are unfamiliar are always potentially threatening, right? Because if you don't know if that noise is a saber-toothed tiger or an orchid opening up,
right,
you need to be a little wary of that. So unfamiliarity breeds fear. It's a biological response. It's necessary because it might be dangerous. So when we become unfamiliar with things, it is scarier. And so now culturally, kids and people even our age who have had much less experience with death, it's much more foreign to them and much more threatening.
Right. And because it's threatening, do we like to put ourselves in denial about it?
Exactly right. Denial would be one of our ways of coping with it.
Well, that's Kubler-Ross, right?
Having fear about it also sort of paralyzes our logic circuits. If I ask you, when do you do your stupidest stuff, you'll say, when I'm really behind under the gun with a deadline,
right,
or I'm mad at somebody, or I'm frustrated about something,
right,
or I'm afraid. So you screw up when you have negative emotion.
Right.
So you aren't very rational. You can't think very clearly or act very clearly. So that's why when people die now, we have a lot of emotion and a lot of people deciding, oh, even though she's 92 and she has advanced cancer, come on, it's grandma, do everything, doc, because we're afraid.
Right. But that still goes back, I think, to the fact that we don't know what comes after. Even if we have Catholicism at our back or Christianity at our back and heaven, we still don't conclusively know. Not to turn this into an argument pro-atheism, but...
No, but I think, you know, we define religious beliefs as being based on faith.
Right.
And when we can't actually measure something or have experience or ask somebody to please come back and tell us what you saw on the other side, and some people speculate that someday we might be able to know these things, but in our current state and historically, we have not been able to know that. So the unknowing gives us fear. Now, many people take great solace in their faith, and their faith tells them about the life hereafter. And that is a good story, and it makes them quite comfortable. And many people who are on their deathbeds who have Christianity as their religion are quite comfortable with their passing because they know internally it is their faith that there's another chapter and they'll be well cared for.
Right. When my mother died, my mother passed of leukemia. And in the home, in hospice care, and first experience with hospice, which I'm convinced that they're all saints. I mean, I'm sure they're not all, but there's a miraculous ability to deal with death and to deal with the living. Anyway, my father climbed into bed with her one night after she'd been home for about 12 days and held her hand and said to her, she had some morphine, but she was conscious, and he said, I guess pretty soon you'll know whether all those stories they've been telling us are true or not. And she smiled, he smiled, went to sleep, and she woke up, he woke up, and she didn't. She was passed. So I always liked that approach to it, or that sense of it. These are wonderful stories. It's a great adventure we get to find out about it. But we don't like the idea of suicide or physician-assisted suicide or end of life or right to die.
Or euthanasia.
Or euthanasia. Or, all the different names for it. We don't like that. We don't like to take it away. And why? And is that because of the unknown? Is that because, as you say, because we just, it's unknown and so we're afraid of it? Or what is it that prevents us when someone is suffering from incurable cancer and we know all the science that we have says it's incurable and we know that they're going to die and they have expressed the wish to die? What is it that keeps driving us? And what is it also that drives science to prolong life rather than to focus on preventing disease? I mean, not that they don't. I know that there's a lot of research that goes into that. But so much, as you said, so much of the science of the last 50 years, it has to do with prolonging life as opposed to finding a way to increase the quality of life earlier.
Well, I think there is a cultural change underfoot. I sense it. And I will speak for a moment to the concept of why does the medical profession push so hard to prolong life, even if we're going to take people's quality of life away. Mm-hmm. Certainly related to the fact that the last 50 years has brought us such great advances and such great ability to interrupt disease process and even cure some things. I think a couple of generations of physicians have been trained in an era where death is less common and that we have so many tools that we have to keep fighting. And specifically because of that, there has been no formal education, or very little, in how to handle people who are dying and how to help them in the last chapter of their lives to be more comfortable, to not have unreal expectations, and to be comfortable instead of getting a cure. Coupled with that, since there's no training in that, and since we as a profession have been trained to keep going and we have something else, now internally we feel that death is a failure on our part. Mm-hmm. And now we have fear of failure. Now, as a species, physicians haven't done much failing. You know, you got 100 on your physics exam and, you know, you didn't get arrested and all of the things that allow you to go to medical school. And you're an achiever, and you don't like to fail. You know how to set goals. So death appears as an unspoken failure, and we have difficulty coping with it ourselves. So when we're afraid to let it happen, because it might look like we could have done more, but we didn't, we fight irrationally.
Right.
It's not true for all of us. And some people have a touch, and some people don't have any touch. And but it is unfamiliar to us, and therefore it's scary to us. Now there's palliative care and hospice care, and these things are...
Define palliative for me. I think I understand the meaning of it. Define it.
Right. Well, it'll be easier if we start with defining hospice.
Okay.
Okay, hospice is not a place. It can be a place. But many people view hospice as the place that you go right before you die to get some morphine so you're comfortable. Mm-hmm. That's a very common misconception. I hear it all the time from very bright people.
Right.
Hospice, in fact, is a philosophy of care. It's a method of delivering care as one approaches the end of their life. And we look at someone and say, we cannot cure this disease. And the more we treat you aggressively to stave off your death, the more miserable we are likely to make you. So let's all realize that this is not a winnable war. Mm-hmm. But how are we going to conduct the last part of the battle here? What services do you need for your physical comfort, for your spiritual health, for your spiritual comfort, for the comfort of your family? What do you need and where would you like to get it? Do you want to die at home? If you poll people, about 89% of people say they would like to die at home in the presence of people that love them or their families, and hopefully that's the same group. In fact, 75% of people die in intensive care units and nursing homes. Mm-hmm. So the need is not being met. So hospice is all about if you want to be at home with your loved ones, and do you need a potty chair next to your bed because you're no longer able to make it to the bathroom? Do you need a pastor to come and talk to you? Do you have any conflicts left over within yourself or with your family or your loved ones that right. might need resolution before you go to make it easier on those who are left behind? Hospice is all about making people comfortable and turning the care to the patient instead of treating the disease. Okay, so that's hospice in a nutshell. It can be in your home. It can be in a facility with bricks and mortar. It can be in a hospital, an acute care hospital that has beds designated for hospice care. And it is paid for by Medicare, for example. Most people die after 65, so Medicare is the usual insurer for that. So you can have hospice care anywhere. And it's very much based on the whole person. Now, we've had hospice care for a number of years, and fewer years ago, palliative care developed. Palliative care is very much like hospice, but there may still be some medical treatments that you would need to undergo or want to undergo so that you might still need a transfusion, or you're still healing up from a kidney operation and you need to see the doctor some more and they need to take the drains out, or there's a period of time maybe right before you would go to hospice where it's really getting closer. And palliative care is that period of time. So you're still maybe having one foot in the need some more treatment category.
To keep you alive or to keep you...
It's when you enter into palliative care, again, you're realizing that you cannot cure the underlying disease. Okay. You are going to make this person comfortable, but there may be a few medical treatments you would still undergo.
Right.
So it's sort of like three quarters of hospice. And that can occur in the home or in a hospital or anywhere else.
Right.
But in fact, if you take these two together, the average length of stay in a hospice program is very short. Nationally, it's 2 weeks. When I was a hospice director, it was 2 days.
Wow.
So the problem is the doctors aren't recommending hospice early enough for the people to take full advantage of that service.
Right.
So they're whacking away and wailing away and trying like heck to keep grandma or dad or whoever it is alive. And then they get right to the end and go, whoops, he's just about dead.
Right.
Did he say he wanted to die at home? Well, let's call hospice. And I don't know how many times I was the supervisor medically over cases where people were admitted at 11:52 at night and they were dead at 1 in the morning.
Right.
Which is really sad.
It is when you consider all the running around and hurrying up and stress that is inflicted upon the person who is dying.
That's right, and you can't resolve conflicts in an hour and a half.
No.
You need weeks and months for that.
Right.
So the entry criterion that a physician has to say about a person when they enroll them in hospice is, it is my professional belief as a physician that this patient has less than 6 months to live. And my opinion is we should have people in hospice for months.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're wrong, if you think they will be dead within 6 months and they live a year, they're recertified at 6 months and recertified again. I had people who were recertified out to 2 and 3 years.
Wow.
But so you don't have to be dead by 6 months. Medicare or the government doesn't come and say, we paid for all this, now give us all our money back because grandma's still alive.
Right. So the death panels that are so much in our headlines and were 2 years ago and are now again are, well, a fiction.
They are a fiction. The death panels are non-existent. Somebody interpreted that element of the proposed health care bill, and they thought it sounded like there might be death panels, like doctors or government agents would be deciding how much care you could get.
Right.
And it was very scary, and people got frightened and weren't thinking clearly. But in fact, there is no such provision in that bill, right. And there never was.
Right. But the physician then does take a huge responsibility in saying conclusively that this patient has 6 months to live.
That's true. But if we are afraid that that might be true or it might be shorter, and if we view it as a failure on our part, rather than getting people into a care modality that would be the most beneficial for them,
right.
We keep them from that opportunity. And we actually harm them with more treatment.
Right.
There are many, many studies we could talk about for hours on end that look at people who live in communities that have more doctors and more surgeons and more specialists and more hospital beds, and many fewer of those people go into hospice programs and get many more procedures and spend many more dollars. But the bottom line is this. People who enter into hospice spend far less money, healthcare dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They have a much higher quality of life at the end of their life. And here comes the kicker. They live longer.
They live longer.
They live That's longer. Great. Statistically, people in hospice live longer than people who are not in hospice and go on being treated.
Well, that makes sense to me. I mean, because I believe in the laying on of hands, not from a biblical point of view, but just that the touch, human touch, and being surrounded by a non-stressed environment, by an environment that we choose to call a loving environment. Like you say, 89% of the people want to die at home surrounded by those who love them. That's palliative, that's healing in some way.
It is. And again, one's spiritual needs, which sometimes are religious and sometimes are not, but one's right. spiritual needs are attended to by that service, and they are very rarely attended to in the midst of another round of chemotherapy or another lopping off of some tumor from
right.
somewhere.
Right.
So you can see where chemotherapy is based on the concept that it's very toxic and it will kill off some of your stuff when it's killing off the cancer too, and we hope that it kills off just cancer and not too much of you, but that never happens.
Right.
So if we keep treating and we cannot win the war, we'll keep knocking off more of you as well. So it's not surprising that people live longer in hospice.
Right. But it's a very fuzzy or wavy or difficult line to see, I suspect, when you come to that line that you have to cross and say, I'm hurting this person more than I'm helping them.
Especially if you have financial incentives to continue treatment.
Yeah. Well,
which are sometimes conscious and sometimes subconscious.
Right.
But, you know, medicine has in sort of an inverted incentive. In the current model, we are rewarded for doing more to people.
Right.
And you don't really get paid for caring for someone. You get paid if you poke them in some way.
Right.
If you do a procedure on them. So
I've always been pretty convinced that doctors, and not you personally, but doctors in a general category, along with lawyers, are better off if you're sick than they are if you're well, like car mechanics.
Right. That's true. And
but I'm a suspicious sort.
Well, you have good reason to be suspicious, but the point is many, many physicians are very altruistic and very honorable and don't do things strictly for money. But the system has rewarded more stuff, so, you know, it's hard to get away from that,
right.
whether you're a good guy or not.
Right.
Now, that brings up the issue, though, of people who are coming into their own death, and some people want to have more say in how that goes.
I would think that anybody would want to have more say. Now, I know that there's a tendency to turn it over to a higher power, and I understand that also, but I would think that anyone would at some point want to say, enough. Enough is enough. And I'd like to just sort of, as you said, when they poll people, everyone wants to die at home and surrounded by people who care for them. But we don't have that right in this state.
In this state, we do not. And that brings up that there are a few different ways that one might exit that we should talk about and define, because the listeners will want to know the difference between A and B.
Right.
And specifically, I'm talking about, we made mention of physician-assisted suicide. Again, this is legal in 3 states in the United States.
Right.
It is legal in many other countries. Physician-assisted suicide is a very specific term. It means that when a patient knows they are going to die, and they approach their physician or another physician about helping them to exit perhaps sooner than they would naturally because they wish to avoid a number of things, like not being able to hold on to their own dignity. They can't clean themselves. They can't get to the bathroom. They can't feed themselves. They can't do this or that. They may not be able to interact with their loved ones in the way that's rewarding to both of those people.
Right.
So they may say, when my disease gets far enough along that I fall off of those types of steps, I want you to help me exit. And the physician then, after clearance from a psychiatrist and a number of experts to make sure that the patient simply is not depressed, because it is depressing to face your own death for most people, when they are sure that depression is not the causative agent for a person's wishes to exit, then in those states in which it is legal, they are able legally to write a prescription for a combination of medications that, if taken according to directions, would end their life. In other words,
administered by the physician or self-administered?
Self-administered or administered by family.
Right.
So the idea is the physician isn't actually killing the patient, but providing the means for the patient to die, So that's called physician-assisted suicide. This has nothing to do with a lethal injection or the doctor even being there. As a matter of fact, in the state of Oregon, where the most number of cases have accumulated because their laws have been longer on the books for 12 or 14 years, the very small number of people who have actually died, the physician has been in attendance at the death in a tiny proportion.
Okay.
So the doctors aren't actually there. It's right. It's a prescription.
Right.
Now, beyond that is the concept of euthanasia. Now, euthanasia is not legal in any state in the United States and is legal in a handful of countries around the world.
Right.
And euthanasia might be considered by some people when they think they are unable to end their own lives and they need right. help to do it. So the doctor can't write the prescription. Or if he does, the likelihood that the patient could take it on their own is absent. Now, to me, personally, one of the best examples of this was shown in an HBO documentary movie called The Suicide Tourist. It's a very touching story of a college professor who I believe was about 58 years old, and he had ALS. ALS is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a progressive neurologic disorder that sort of starts at the tips of your fingers and the tips of your toes and works its way back up.
Right.
And finally gets up to your head and your neck, but your brain is fine all the way through this until it's not. But the problem is you lose your physical capability for doing lots of things while your brain is just fine.
Right.
This is torture for most people. And I personally, as a physician, have seen cases where people are in a hospital bed, sometimes even in an ICU, where all they can do is move a little stick that tells the computer to type a letter and it makes a word. Mm-hmm. And this is their existence. Now, that's a fine existence for some people. They're happy. They're able to communicate with their loved ones. And that's fine. But for many people, they don't want to get that far and have suffered that much
right.
and create an economic burden on their family. Because these things are horribly expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And insurance companies have had a habit of canceling your insurance when you have something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the tremendous
habit they're developing more and more lately.
Well, and the new healthcare legislation is trying to remove that capability from them so they can't take it away. But again, that's another topic. So if this particular guy was 58, and there's a service based out of Switzerland called Dignitas. And he found out about it on the internet, and he paid somewhere around $3,500 or $4,000 and flew to Switzerland. And he was unable to walk and unable to write and unable to do lots of things. He could talk. He could still talk. He was less intelligible than before, but a bright guy, a college professor. His wife accompanied him, and they checked into a hotel in Switzerland, and they phoned the Dignitas people, and the Dignitas people send over a physician and a psychologist. And they talk to the guy and examine him and make sure that he's not horribly depressed.
Right.
They talk to the spouse. They look over all the paperwork. And they say, we'll be back in 3 days. Because if you want to change your mind, we can understand that. And something might come up where you might want to say, you know what, maybe I've been rash. I don't want to do this. So they give you plenty of time. So this man was in the hotel for 3 days, and they came back and saw him. And they gave him a potion of sedatives and barbiturates, and they said, if you drink this, you will die. And he said, that is my intent. I want to get out now. I love my wife very much. I'm still able to interact with her, but I'm getting close. And she said, I agree. We've talked about this many times. And he drank the potion, and
died.
30 minutes later, he died.
Peacefully, quietly,
peacefully,
calmly.
Quietly. His wife was with him by his own choice in the method that he had chosen.
Right.
Now, that's called euthanasia. And that is, again, not legal in this country
right.
and is legal in a handful of countries. And there are a lot of people who think that this goes against natural law and that the Creator gets to decide these things. But I want to make sure the listeners know each of these terms and exactly what they mean.
Right. I wish this discussion were a perpetual discussion, not just between you and I, but that between everyone, that we could talk about this more freely and more openly. We have a limited amount of time today. But I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to me, and maybe we'll re-up this conversation some other time.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much.